Thank you very much. Thank you, Matt and Gosha. Yes, we were on the exec meetings from, I think, probably 2000. And so that's quite a lot of years between us, actually. So, yeah, a lot of meetings together. And when I was talking about becoming chair at Adistana, there were a few people that I wanted to bring into the room together and have that conversation and what I was going to do. And Ratna Gosha was one of them. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So here I am amongst all of you, and I've got a formal talk to give, and then I look at you and think, oh, it'd be just great to just have a big chat. I can tell you about my time with Bante, all that sort of thing would be great. Yeah. He'll be delighted to know that I'm here, and he'll want to know all about it. I've been in contact with him while I've been living at Adistana, so we've probably exchanged probably about 100 emails during that time, and I see him every 2 to 4 weeks, something like that. So quite a lot of time together. And we always have tea together now and cake and all that sort of stuff. It's lovely. And, yeah, those interviews, when you hear the interviews that I've done with him, you hear him in relation to me. And you hear him in relationship, I suppose, which is a very different Bante, actually, than the formal talks. And at the end of the first series, he gave me a present. He gave me this piece of green stone that was the subject of a poem that he'd written that I'd done an interview around. And I remember going to that morning session. We'd started really early because the clocks had changed. So he'd still insisted on meeting at 9:30, which was officially 8:30 in the morning. And I'd gone in and he said, I want you to read this poem on greenstone. I said, okay, Bante. And he said, I thought we could rehearse it. I said, okay. And so I read it, and he said, I think it needs to be more dramatic. I said, for goodness sake, it's 9:30 in the morning, which is really 8:30, and you want me to do dramatic poetry? He said, yes, Adnandi. Anyway, a few months later, after the interviews had been finished, he gave me that piece of greenstone. And when I showed it to somebody from New Zealand, because it's a piece of, you know, it's a piece of jade from New Zealand. Mm-hmm. My friend Vajajoti said, you have no idea how auspicious that is, mm-hmm. because it's very symbolic rock that chieftains and people have, and she said to receive it from your teacher is very precious. So yes, my life with Bante. So yes, I got an email from Ratna Gosha a few months ago that said, I think the subject was probably come and give a talk, and I thought, no, I'm not going to do that. I'm too busy to do that. And then he said, and then of course you read the email eventually, and it says, come and give a talk on the ideal of human enlightenment. And I thought, oh, that's a lecture that I really love. Okay, I'll come and do that. So hence I'm here. So I'm going to follow the structure of the talk to some extent, follow Bante's structure, and then just put in a few of my own reflections. That's what I'm going to do. Yes, I'm going to talk a bit about ideals, so the ideal of human enlightenment. So I'm going to talk about ideals, and I'm going to talk a bit about what enlightenment is. Get me. And then I'm going to talk a bit about how we know enlightenment is an ideal for us. And then I'm going to say something about the affirmation that enlightenment is possible. So ideals, and how to hold a vision, or how to live with an ideal. Actually, it took me quite a long time to get ordained. Samata will know this, because she was my Kalyana Mitra through quite a lot of that process. And it took me, I think probably 11 years from when I'd gone along to the Buddhist Centre to me getting ordained. You put a lot under your belt in the 11 years, so it's probably worth it. And I asked a friend at Tariloka once I'd heard I was going to be ordained. I said to her, why has it taken me so long to get ordained? And she said, well, one of the reasons, I think, is that you've got a big vision, which is a kind of interesting reply. And I've never understood it totally, but maybe if you've got a big vision, it takes a while to know how to live with that and what to do with that. And I think probably a lot of those 11 years was just me working that out. So I think we all need to learn to live with a vision, or how to live with ideals. They're rather like having hot coal in one's pocket, you know. You have to know how to handle them, otherwise you just get burnt. So the word ideal in the dictionary means a conception of something in its absolute perfection, one that is regarded as a standard or model of perfection or excellence, an ultimate or worthy object of endeavour, a goal. So Norman Fisher, Zen practitioner, he says, ideals are reflections of our deeply religious nature. But as we know, ideals can be poison if we take them in large quantities or if we take them incorrectly. In other words, if we take them not as ideals, but as concrete realities. Ideals should inspire us to surpass ourselves, which we need to aspire to do if we are truly human, and which we can never actually do exactly because we're truly human. Ideals are tools for inspiration, not realities in themselves. The fact that we have so often missed this point accounts for the sorry state, the sorry history of religion in human civilization. If rightly understood, ideals make us light-hearted and give us a sense of direction. So I want to just say a bit about holding a vision, holding ideals. So often we're very cynical about ideals, we're very cynical about having a vision. I think this is partly a sort of pseudo-intelligence, actually. It's sort of clever to be a bit kind of distant from ideals. And you think you're thinking it through if you say, you know, you're not taken in by something. And it seems a very sort of intelligent, sort of cool stance to not sort of be a bit distant from ideals or a vision. Yeah. But it's interesting because I think that stance is often half-baked. It's not a very intelligent thing. You're not thinking it through. To really think something through gives you an ability to be confident with those ideals. I think sometimes also we don't connect with an ideal because we're using the wrong words. They seem too abstract or we don't relate to them. I mean, like going for refuge. I mean, that's a very particular language, isn't it? Going for refuge or three jewels. It takes us a while to work out what the real words are in that metaphor, as it were. Sometimes they just seem too high. You need to see them more as just a general direction that we can continually orientate towards, and just expect ideals or the kind of expect the process of having a vision to be a process of maturing and deepening. So I just want to ask you a question. Don't have to answer it right now. Are you nourished or are you burdened by ideals? Do you use ideals as another form of self-criticism? I think we can sometimes do that. We have an ideal and it's another way that we think we're a bad person or we're inadequate or whatever. Just what is your relationship to ideals in that sense? Where do you experience cynicism? Someone being enthusiastic in the Buddhist centre? That can draw out quite a lot of cynicism. In a puja, when people are going a bit holy, chanting, or a personal failure, we get very cynical about experience then. Can you admit to having ideals, even, to your mother, to your friend? Can you admit to having an ideal? So I'm going to talk a bit about a few areas that I've noticed that have stopped me being able to relate to a vision or an ideal. So doubt is one of them. So Bhante Sangharakshita says, doubt is a kind of camouflage. If you don't take up a clear position, no one can attack you. You are beyond criticism. Or rather, you haven't reached a point where you can be criticised. You might not be certain, but at least you can never be wrong. And this is a comfortable position, or non-position, to be in. Doubt is essentially resistance to the positive, forward-looking spirit of the path. As soon as you are convinced that the Buddha was enlightened, you have to take what he said seriously enough to actually do something about it. If, on the other hand, you give yourself the luxury of doubting whether the Buddha was really enlightened at all, or at least postponing committing yourself to a view until you are really sure, you don't need to take his teaching so seriously. And best of all, You don't need to do anything about it. The ideal way to free yourself from doubt is thus to clarify your thinking, not necessarily in a bookish or abstract way, but simply by reflecting on what you know of the spiritual path. It's very interesting to note that it's clarity that counteracts doubt, not faith. You know, it requires you to think something through. We're often very heady, and we're also often very unclear at the same time. We're not really turning towards our experience. We're not really thinking something through. I'm going to be saying a bit more about that later. Confusion. There can be some confusion when we stand in relation to ourselves as we are right now, with all our limitations and reactivity, and then to see the ideal of what we want to become. Closing the gap between the real and the ideal is quite tricky, and it's not an easy thing to be in relationship to those two things. I think quite often we falter and we dismiss one of them. So either we dismiss self, think, I'm rubbish and I'm never going to be able to do that, or we dismiss the ideal, the vision, and we think that's never going to be attainable, that's rubbish, I'm never going to do that. Very hard to stand in relationship to both. I sometimes think, we say that when people are ready to be ordained, their going for refuge becomes effective. And I sometimes think it's when, at that point, we've learned how to effectively stand in relationship to ourselves as we are now and ourselves as we're going to become, or our vision or the goal. Okay. It's a funny old relationship, that, and it's not a comfortable one sometimes. We often feel inadequate, or we get cynical about the ideal itself. Laziness. Laziness is another way where you can get you can put off relating to a vision or an ideal. I give up very easily. I get despondent. It's very easy to lack faith in relationship to a vision. That's the easy way out. Despondency is easier. To have faith is harder. I remember being with a friend once on a retreat. We were both order members, and we were leading a study retreat together. And we were studying something, I think it might be in the Pali Canon, and she suddenly realised that the Buddha had a personality. I don't know what it was that we were studying, but she kind of woke up to the fact that the Buddha had a personality, which was great, because she had a personality as well. And she realised that she was going to get enlightened with the personality that she was. Okay. And this was a revelation, because I think she thought she was going to become middle class and intellectual, which she wasn't, or something. And she discovered she was going to do it differently, and she was really on fire with this. Anyway, we were living together at that time, and she came to me a few days later, and she said, oh, it's not like that, is it, Sanandi? It's not like that. It's never going to be like that. I'm not going to do it like that, am I? It's not going to work out for me. And I said, look, that's the easy way out. What you're doing right now, and she thinks she's giving herself a hard time. I said, no, you're giving yourself an easy time. It's much, much harder to stay with the faith and that experience that you've just had in that study group, where you realise something's possible for me. It's much harder to flop back into despondency. She was a bit shocked at that. I think she thought I was going to do something nice and kind. And I didn't. She had this moment of flash in her face. And she looked at me and she said, I said, yes, you're trying to work out if you're going to throw me out the window or yourself right now. And I know that feeling. So nihilism, eternalism is very interesting. I think in this area it can sometimes be they're both ways where we're lazy about taking up a vision. So when we're nihilistic, and I was very nihilistic, I am still quite nihilistic. This was another reason why I didn't get ordained for a long time. When you're very nihilistic, nothing adds up for you. It's all a bit meaningless. And so you apply yourself a bit, briefly, and whatever you're trying to do doesn't quite work out. You go on a retreat, you get a bit more concentrated, you feel a bit more bright, you go home, and it's just the same old, yeah? And you get a bit despondent, and you feel it's not working, and it's all a bit hopeless, and you settle back into a sort of nihilistic state where you just have the freedom to do whatever you want. That's quick and easy. Anyone can do that. Eternalism, you work a bit harder. You have a vision, you go on retreat, you follow the spiritual life, and you make a bargain with reality. You think, if I'm a really good mitra, if I'm a really good order member, and I do all the right things, I study the right things, and I have friends with the right people, everything will add up. And eventually, in the future, I'll end up in a great life. It'll be easier for me. It'll be more secure, a bit more pleasant. Things will be going well. And then what happens, okay? You hear the bad news about your teacher. The meditations don't go so well. You struggle a bit with your lover. You can't quite understand a bit of the Dharma and it doesn't make sense anymore. And suddenly you think, they haven't kept their side of the bargain. Okay, I've done all the work and I was failed by my teacher. That Kalyana Mitra didn't work out. The Dharma doesn't really work. That side of the bargain didn't work out anymore. So it's a bit of a longer route, but eventually you feel justified in not really committing yourself. You don't need to do what, but you don't need to make any effort anymore or whatever. And you just set back into a more justified sort of laziness that you had before. So I think a lot of us have to learn to hold, just how to hold ideals, and how to mature our vision, and how to rise above that quality of despondency when faced with the fact that more effort is needed. So I think you need to look at, look at your resistance to effort, and whether it's eternalism or nihilism showing up. So what is our idea? What is an ideal? Well, the Buddhist answer would just be enlightenment. For a human being, enlightenment is the ideal. I attended art school as a young woman, and you have ideals when you go to art school, and you have role models, Van Gogh. He doesn't look like a great role model, but he was. I tell you. I had a vision of a vocational life. In fact, I wrote down all the things, and I discovered that's the life I am actually leading. So that's kind of interesting. But anyway, so I had a vision of a focused, creative, single-minded vocational life that started very early in the morning and finished very late at the night. Which is the life that I do have. And the guy that I was going out with at the time was very, very interested in Buddhism. He was also very interested in acid, hash, speed, and all sorts of other things as well. But that's a different story. And at one point he was trying to teach me a bit about Buddhism, and he said, exchange your vision, the vision that you have as an artist, for a human being, which is kind of interesting. I mean, it's also interesting I've still ended up with the same life. It's interesting how we frame ourselves. You know, are we a teacher? Are we a human being? Are we a parent? Because that does indicate sometimes what our ideals are in our life and what our aims are, where we're trying to go. What is the frame of reference? So you could have a look at how you frame your life. Do you think of yourself as a human being, trying to do something as a human being? Do you think of yourself as something else? I'm not saying it's right or wrong. I'm just saying just notice how you frame yourself. So enlightenment is the ideal for a human being. Okay. So what is enlightenment? So to quote Bhante in this lecture, he says three main things, which he says all Buddhist schools believe in. It's a state of pure, clear awareness, an awareness of reality, a state of direct, unmediated spiritual vision that sees all things directly, clearly, vividly, and truly. It is a spiritual vision which is free from all delusion, all misconception, all wrong, crooked thinking, all vagueness, all obscurity, all mental conditioning, all prejudice. One. Then it's an estate, a state of intense, profound, overflowing love and compassion. And finally, a state of inexhaustible mental and spiritual energy, of perfect, unconditioned freedom from all subjective limitations. I think probably some aspects of that description will chime more for you than others. I had, for a long, long time, I had a very strong connection with the quality of freedom. I mean, what does it mean to be free from limitations or restrictions? As somebody who did a lot of self-editing in a lot of things that I said, what did it feel like to feel you could just say, you know, be yourself, really be yourself, and be free from limitations like that? I think we, our spiritual life, the way that we develop is very much according with our personality. Some of us are more emotional, some of us have got more clarity, some of us are just naturally energetic. How we grow will chime with our personality. The values that we respond to will be connected to our own personal values, and it will be connected to our personality. I've learned over the years that I've become more and more myself, more individual in myself, more unique in myself. And at the same time, the values that I hold get more and more universal and more the same as a lot of other people's. It's just an interesting process, that sense of becoming more the same as in a more universal way and also more different at the same time. So enlightenment. So one of the Zen Roshis says, strictly speaking, there are no enlightened people. There is only enlightened activity. I quite like this statement. So I look for enlightened activity in the people that I know. And what I'm looking for is particularly the quality of freedom from the eight worldly winds. So I'm looking for people, and I'm looking for actions, speech, behaviour that is less sort of driven by a need for pleasure and pain, or a need for praise, or a need for blame, blaming others, or looking for blame for themselves. Less of a drive towards loss and gain, fame and infamy. Less blown around by all of that. When you see people being less blown around by that, you see they've got something quite substantial going on in themselves. This means they're drawing on something much deeper in themselves. I mean, I just wonder if, you know, you can ask yourself what kind of polarity shows up in you. Is there a kind of pair that battle out in your personality a little bit, and whether that sort of chimes a lot with the worldly winds? Just notice that. I grew up, that's not going to work right. I've got two lovely sisters, but actually psychologically I've got two ugly sisters. Mm-hmm. Okay. So I'm going to say spiritually I've grown up with two ugly sisters, like in a Cinderella story. So they both want a piece of the action. So one ugly sister, she's kind of, she's a bit more extrovert. She's a bit of a Dolly Parton sort of, da-da. And if I did anything that I thought was quite good, she'd go, da-da. And if I did anything that I felt was a bit, I could be criticised for, I had another ugly sister. And she was more like a kind of headmistress in a kind of tweed suit. I knew their wardrobes. And you didn't do that right. You should have known that person takes tea, not coffee, or whatever it is, okay? So the two ugly sisters battle out in my psyche sometimes. And I thought, at some point I saw them. God, they're quite intense. And It's like you can't do anything. You can't even make a cup of tea without an ugly sister wanting to do something with that. Yeah? And I began to think, what would it be like if just for a time I just didn't listen to them? So what starts happening then is you begin to have your own experience without the ugly sisters. You begin to have an experience of your own which is not driven by one of those winds, one of those polarities. And that experience began to add up something for me. It's a much deeper, richer experience. So I had my own experience suddenly, rather than Dolly Parton going, da-da, didn't I do well? I felt just this really strong sense of satisfaction that I'd done something well. It was a very different experience. And when I did something I felt a bit sad about or ashamed of, I was just in contact with that. But my experience began to fill me up. I don't know if that makes sense. It's like I became filled up with my own experience, okay? Yeah, so this is about being free from the eight worldly winds. There's another teaching, mind training teaching. It says all dharmas converge on a single point. So basically all dharmas, all teachings converge on a single point, which is to transform and go beyond ego clinging or self clinging. So in other words, all teachings are about teaching us how to let go of the ego, how to let go of selfishness, how to let go of self-clinging. So, well, how's that going to show up? I mean, actually, it's very interesting, isn't it? You can often see when people are gripping onto themselves, that sort of self-assertion thing that's going on in people's behaviour. And you feel it in yourself sometimes through the heat. When Dolly Parton's got hold of me, there's a piece of hotness in me. When we self-assert about, you know, it can be, it's quite a trivial thing. Someone can, you know, you can say, oh, the directions to Marks and Spencer's is you do this, you do that, and you turn left. And then somebody from the outside of the other side of the room says, you turn right. No, left. Even in that moment, there's a bit of heat there. Grip. There's a bit of self-clinging there. The other person feels it too. Yeah. We all feel that in each other. Yes. Mm-hmm. It's not just that eventually we become aware of it, you become aware that other people are aware of it as well. That sort of spark in us. Yeah. So that's where we grip. And you feel it in yourself, don't you? That kind of fist that closes. Grip. Yeah. So all dharmas, all teachings are teaching you to let go of that. Yeah, stand free of that, that kind of illusion that there's a self there that needs protecting, that needs to be right. Yeah. Okay, so this is me describing a little bit more what enlightenment is. It's not that charge anymore, and that's what we're working with. So how do we know that this state of enlightenment is the ideal for us? So in his lecture, Bhante says there's two kinds of ideals, a natural ideal and an artificial ideal. So a natural ideal takes into consideration the nature of the thing or the person for which it is an ideal. An artificial does not do this, but imposes itself from the outside in an artificial manner. So enlightenment, for all its lofty kind of ideals in it, enlightenment is not an artificial ideal. It's not something imposed from the outside. It's in accordance with our nature. There's an aspect of enlightenment in us already. It corresponds to our nature and to our needs. If only we can feel that. Beyond the ugly sisters, standing free of the ugly sisters, you begin to feel that. You feel your own values. You feel who you are. Well, I think it takes a long time to naturalise that experience of knowing that enlightenment is, you know, is a natural ideal for you. Another way that we know it's a natural ideal is that nothing else really satisfies us. Now, that's just a piece of jargon, unless you've really experienced it. I remember reading a book about a child who had quite a serious disability from when it was a baby, the child was a baby, and its brain didn't quite work. The boy's brain didn't quite work. And the mother was training it, helping it learn how to do something. And she took it to a special school, and they were gradually helping reopen the channels in the child's mind. And the mother was trying to get the child to do something by offering it a sweet or some ice cream, and the child wasn't interested. And then one of the teachers was offering the child a new tool, and the child really, really was interested in that. And the teacher said something very interesting. She said, a child naturally wants to learn more than it wants ice cream. Mm-hmm. And I felt really so touched by that, because I thought, actually, that's a human situation. We naturally want to learn more than we want ice cream, really. Really, Vicky. Yeah. Well, that's kind of interesting again, isn't it? Is that really true for you? Just noticing that. And, let's see. So there are qualities that constitute enlightenment that are already found in us. It's in it's natural in every man, woman and child, these qualities. We're not trying to become something different. We're just trying to become even more than we are now. There's a kind of natural affinity with us. You know, when you see somebody speaking the truth, there's a kind of resonance with that. Or when you see someone functioning kindly, there's a sort of resonance with that. The Dharma's got a beautiful, natural truth to it, if only we allow ourselves to respond to it. I was in a school, when I was living at Toloko, I went to a school and taught for a morning, I taught possibly 8-year-olds. It's very hard to tell. Once they're only this high, you can't work out what age they are. All I know is the furniture was very small. I do remember that. And I was standing in front of this class, and we were talking about the four sights, as you do, and I was going through the sights, first sight, second sight, and we had this really strong rapport. We went through this sort of trick where they didn't seem to understand that we were going to go through it over and over again, where I would say something like, so what did the Buddha see? And they would say, well, the Buddha first saw an ill person. And then I'd say, so who knows what an ill person looks like? Tell me what they're like. So they tell me what an ill person looks like. And then I say, and who wants to get ill? Nobody wants to get ill. And then I'd say, and who's going to get ill? And we're all going to get ill. And we did that over and over again through the sights. They never thought it was going to happen again, but it did. Yeah. It was quite shocking when we got to the dead person. Anyway, and there was this little girl over here who, because a bit like where Ratnagosha was sitting, unfortunately I was facing here, so I wasn't really taking her in, but I could hear her. And she was saying, oh no, oh no, oh no, like this. I could just hear her. And then she was saying, I never think like this. I never think like this. And then we moved on to the true refugees a little bit. We talked about forced refugees, as you do with 8-year-olds. And they get it like that. Mm. And then we talk about the forced refugees a bit. And we talk about forced refugees. And then while we're talking about that, she's going to me, it's just got to stop. It's just got to stop. So I turned to her and I said, okay, Zen Master, what has to stop? And she said, we've just got to stop wanting so much. Mm-hmm. And it was an amazing moment for me, because I saw that the Dharma was totally natural. Totally natural. Mm-hmm. Yeah. That you just had to see those sights, and you understood something. that little girl totally understood it. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And then we talked about the true refugees, which was a bit different from your true refugees, but they were true refugees. Yeah. Yeah. So my own experience is that enlightenment is a natural ideal in my life. It didn't always feel like that because I'm a nihilist. But there was a period of time leading up to my ordination where I didn't know I was going to be ordained, but I was blossoming in a certain kind of way. And I came across Vasubandhu's four factors. I was on a retreat studying them. And, So in Vasubandhu's four factors, there's one particular factor, and this had a really big impact on me because I became convinced by it. I think of the Buddha, I think of Shakyamuni, and of other enlightened beings, and I reflect. As they were, so am I. What they became, so may I become. They started off as human beings, so do I. They started off with weaknesses and imperfections, so do I. They started off with all sorts of limitations, and so do I. But then, look what they achieved. They transcended their limitations. They became Buddhas. They were human. I am human. What they achieved, I too can achieve, if only I make the effort. And it was like a fourth sight for me when I read that verse, and I thought, I knew that that was true, and I became utterly convinced that that was true. And then I thought, if I totally believe that verse, then that means now my whole life stretches in front of me. I don't have to worry about any choices anymore. I know now what I'm doing with the rest of my life. The rest is history. I found myself in a very dynamic relationship with my vision, and it was totally mutual. I don't know how to put it in a different way than that. I knew it was true. And it was almost like the words themselves were working into me as well. So it was like I was looking at it, but it was looking at me. Kind of enlightenment was possible, and it was possible for me. In fact, several months later, I remember being on a retreat and throwing up on the first night. And Sangha Devi, who was my preceptor, and I was in her study group at that time, she said to me, "What are you doing, Sadhanandi, at the moment?" And I said, just reflecting on the Dharma, and she said, "But what's actually happening?" And I said, "I realise the spiritual life really is possible for me, and I'm afraid it's making me throw up at night." I was utterly convinced that it was possible, and in that period, I got out of the shower one day and I thought, "Wow, enlightenment is easier than I thought. Enlightenment is easier than I think. I don't have to be perfect. I just have to see the way things really are." And to be honest, that's easier. So perfectionism is a kind of interesting value. It's rubbish as a value, by the way. Perfectionism is just a form of ignorance, so just give it up. It's a true fact. Yeah. So you don't have to be perfect, you just have to see things the way they are. I think all of us need confirmation that the spiritual life is possible. And we get that through Kalyana Mitrata. Sometimes people can reflect you back in a way where you know you're on the map somewhere. I remember after this sort of period where I was really blossoming very strongly around my ordination. And then from then on, it was just hard graft at Taraloka or wherever. And I remember speaking to one of my friends, one of my meditation teachers. And I said to her, "It's not beautiful anymore. It's just a lot of hard work." And she said, "But Sadhananda, you had a year where it was just the path of vision for you. And now you're on the path of transformation. And you're stitching that vision into your life, and that's a different piece of work." How great to have somebody put you on the map like that. We all need somebody that can do that at Kalyana Mitrata. we need some confirmation that enlightenment is possible for us, that real progress is possible for us, and we need to know that it's happening in our lives. Where are you going to get that confirmation from? Here's a good question for you. What do you use as an authority in your life? Because that's what you're going to need. You're going to need an authority in your life that tells you it's starting to add up for you now. Friends can do it, yes, but you're going to need an inner authority. Something inside you that knows it's adding up now. I think Subhuti says, he looks a bit at reason and emotion, and does this in that series of lectures that he did a long time ago on the mythic context, I think it is. He says, so sometimes we take reason as an authority. He says, reason can only analyse and relate. It has no impetus of its own. It is a tool. It cannot know life because it can only relate on the basis of previous assumptions. Emotions blindly responds, loving and hating according to previous conditions. Neither in itself is able to know. So clearly neither in itself is able to pursue the spiritual life, is able to fuel us on the spiritual life. What we need is intelligent feelings and feeling intelligence. What's needed is not either reason or emotion, but another higher faculty which unites and transcends both and which perceives spiritual truth. So this quality is faith, Shraddha. And once I discovered that, that's where my name's come from, so my name is to do with faith. So faith is an ability to have confidence and an ability to trust spiritual intuition, and that is the real authority in your life. That ability to trust your spiritual intuition and hear it, feel it in yourself. What do you have as an authority in your lives? Something that informs and directs your actions. What is it? Doubt and nihilism was an authority for a while in me. Well, for the first 40 years. It's interesting what we take as an authority in our lives. Like some people will argue they can't believe in enlightenment, they can't believe in the Buddha, they don't see the evidence, they don't see enough evidence, maybe. And yet, if somebody doesn't speak to them during the tea break, that's enough evidence for them to form a huge amount of views and assumptions about what that person is and what they think about them. Mm-hmm. So we base tons of views and assumptions on very little material. Okay, well, I rest my case. So just think, what story are you investing in right now? Mm-hmm. Right? What are you using as an authority in your life right now? Once I'd seen that I needed to find that authority for myself, I started looking for it. And I looked for it in where I was saying yes, that's the faith response. An act of kindness between two people and I can feel it. Yes. In myself, yes. That makes sense. A moment in a talk where someone looks more authentic or clear, I think yes. There's something there, a faith response. I think we think faith is about having an idea about a teaching, like, oh yeah, I believe in karma, or I believe in this, or I believe in that. It's not that. It's about being alive to a set of values and seeing those values in your life and then feeling that response and then knowing that that's a guiding principle. That's what faith is. Mbanti describes faith, I think, possibly in a survey, where he says, faith is like when a glass vibrates, when there's when a violin hits a certain note in the room. Yeah. And you've got to learn to hear that spiritual intuition vibrate in the room when it's in contact with the Dharma, when it's in contact with something higher or something more true. Notice how you use language so you don't disguise it. You know, you think, oh, yeah, I'm feeling quite good, or that made me feel quite good. Don't say I feel quite good. Say I just had a faith response. Call it that. Also, faith is a prefiguration of truth, of insight. And if that faith response is a knowing, that's why it's spiritual intuition, a direct experience of what's really happening right there. spiritual intuition. So take faith as an authority. That isn't a belief, that isn't an empty belief. That's a real chime of integrity in you. Learn what that is and then allow that to be an authority in your life. So do you live in a landscape of faith? And if not, then what is your landscape? What do you use as an authority in your life? So about 20 years ago, I stopped being concerned about the nature of enlightenment and what it was. I started noticing more what my responses were to certain actions and behaviours in the world, and what carried values for me. I began to see enlightened action that indicated more awareness, less self-clinging, more kindness, more freedom, less of the worldly winds. I began to notice that, and I noticed that in myself. So then you begin to know there's a set of governing kind of rules in yourself, or governing values in yourself, and you begin to take leadership from them. Okay, that's a real clarity. That's you using your mind well when you're starting to work that all out for yourself. There's this beautiful quote from Middleton Murray that Bhante uses at the beginning of he uses on the front page of his History of Going for Refuge. He says, Middleton Murray says, "To discover that within myself which I must obey, to gain some awareness of the law which operates in the organic whole of the internal world, to feel this internal world as an organic whole working out its whole destiny according to some secret vital principle, to know which acts and utterances are a liberation from obstacles and an accession of strength, to acknowledge secret loyalties which one cannot deny without impoverishment and starvation. This is to possess one's soul indeed, and it is not easy either to do or to explain." So we need to find that inner world. You know, find that inner life working out its own secret loyalties and destiny. Hear the faith response and use that spiritual intuition so that the spiritual life is confirmed for you, that it is possible to lead it. Then the ideal of enlightenment isn't just an ideal anymore. You've naturalized it. Yeah, just a case of time, isn't it? So I'll just finish with Bhante's last paragraph from that lecture. "Nowadays, we have to recognise that many people are sceptical about ideals, and especially so, perhaps, about spiritual ideals, about the possibility of transforming the real into the ideal. Buddhism, however, is not sceptical. It has faith in the ideal, faith in the spiritual ideal, faith in the ideal of human enlightenment. And it has faith in the ideal because it has faith in us, in the creative potential of humanity. Because it has faith in us, it asks that we have faith in ourselves. It does not ask us to believe, least of all to believe in Buddhism. Instead, it asks us to take the ideal of human enlightenment as a practical working hypothesis. It asks us to make the experiment. It asks us to try." Thank you.